listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean, with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, coming to us from Managua, Nicaragua. So, Tony, I looked at the election returns, and for a minute I thought Hezbollah was about to take over Honduras when I saw it was Nasrallah. I guess that's his cousin, Salvador, and not Hassan.
Right. Yeah, and Nasrallah may well turn out to be the savior of Honduras.
Mm-hmm, as Hezbollah has helped to save Syria.
Right. Who knows? And it's still not clear because whereas the election observers from different organizations said that the vote itself was very calm and apparently well organized, in Honduras, everything depends on who wins the count.
Yeah, and also who, as Stalin is famously quoted as saying, who counts the votes?
Right, yeah. And so in this case, Juan Orlando Hernandez had everything stacked in his favor. He's got the electoral, his people on the electoral tribunal, his people controlling the Supreme Court, which, as you pointed out last time, he did via sacking four Supreme Court justices whenever it was 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
And nobody anywhere said anything. Neither governments nor the international corporate media thought that was worth any attention at all. And so he controls the ultimate judicial decision that might result if this election result ends up in the courts.
Right.
All the signs are that Salvador Nasrallah, who leads the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, political grouping, mostly made up of the Libre organization, political movement, led by Mel Zelaya and his wife Xiomara Castro, and their colleagues who did extremely well in the 2013 election, the first election after the coup d'état in 2009. But not well enough to be on their own as a party, right, to be the national party led by Juan Orlando Hernandez, which controls everything, right, or institutionally, and where they didn't control things institutionally, as I mentioned earlier, and they took steps to make sure that they did control the Supreme Court. So the rule of thumb to remember in Honduras is that no single party is likely ever to get more than 40% of the vote.
Right, it's three-way.
Now, an alliance of parties could do so, and that's what's happened. And Salvador Nasralla was chosen. Why was he chosen as the leader of this new electoral alliance against the dictatorship? Because, as we mentioned in our last conversation, back in those 2013 elections, whereas Libre got, according to the official results, and you have to take those with a big pinch of salt. According to the official results, Libre got something over 28% and Nasralla got something around 12%. So together, they had 40% of the vote. And if they'd gone into those elections back in 2013, they'd have defeated Juan Orlando Hernandez, whose national party, one of the traditional political parties in Honduras, got 36 plus something.
Right.
And those were the official results. But I remember very well the election night. And on election night, the results looked like something like 33% for Juan Orlando Hernandez and 32-point-something% for the Libre Party led by Xiomara Castro.
Right.
And then magically, everything kind of got changed.
It's funny how that happens, huh?
Funny how that happens, right? So now, and we're looking at this situation, I had to laugh, actually, reading one of the reports where one of the election observers, I've forgotten which one it was, said that usually in Honduran elections, we get a result by 9 o'clock at night. And so they were expressing concern that there still hadn't been a result later that night, later last night.
Right.
And so far, there's no official definitive result as far as, unless you've seen something.
No,
most
recent thing I see is what's at Telesur. And that still shows 57% returns. They closed, I guess, they stopped counting at 3 a.m. Last, this 4 a.m. They closed the voting at 4 p.m. And as of 3 a.m., the numbers were Nasralla 45.17, Hernandez 40.21, Zelaya, but not Mel Zelaya, Zelaya Medrano, whether it's Luis Party.
Luis Zelaya, and that's interesting because that Liberal Party, their vote has dropped.
Right.
That's
13.77, and the total vote count so far was 57%. So.
Right. So and the fundamental thing is that this political alliance between progressive forces and kind of slightly middle of the road forces that ran on Salvador Nasralla ran on an anti-corruption platform last time. That combination has got apparently well over 40% of the vote. And unless my rule of thumb is completely wrong, and it hasn't been for decades, and that you can't expect that Juan Orlando Hernandez is going to get more than 40%. So it looks like a clear win for a moderately progressive political movement. But and the reason I thought it was so funny that election observer guy said that usually you get a result by 9 o'clock in Honduras is that on the basis of what is he saying that? Because every election prior to the 2013 election, And including the 2013 election has been a complete mess. Right. And the 2006 election, they took a whole month to get definitive results because the national political leadership of all the different political parties back then in 2006 were cutting a deal behind the scenes. Right. And it had, you know, it had next to nothing to do with the actual electoral results.
Yep.
No, and that from that process, Mel Zelaya came out ahead, and he was expected to be a typical liberal party, a traditional liberal party caudillo, kind of just going through the motions of making progressive noises and actually working solidly on behalf of the Honduran oligarchy. That was what was expected of Mel Zelaya back in 2006, but he didn't. Right. He actually started doing real stuff, like taking measures for the benefit of Honduras's impoverished majority,
right,
and actually trying to cut back on the privileges of the Honduran oligarchy, and that was what the coup was all about. Yeah. Back in 2009,
right? Because he was also expected to have a 4-year term, and instead he didn't, because he started doing the other things that were unexpected.
Yeah, and that was totally bizarre, because the guy who eventually won the 2009, and the coup happened something like 5 months before the elections in 2009, and I've never understood why, because the National Party were going to win those elections. There was very little doubt at all that Porfirio Lobo was going to win the elections in 2009, which he subsequently did, under conditions that were essentially military coup conditions.
Yeah.
So why did they carry out the military coup? It's very, very weird.
You know.
Anyway.
You can see also coming into this election, the same thing that we've seen with the polls, essentially being weaponized, that we saw elsewhere. Yeah. The poll that's been held out, and it's the one cited at Telesur this morning, is from Televicentro, which is the television station in Honduras. They merged the four TV stations that they had, sort of a la the 96 Telecommunications Act in the United States, into one TV station, one owner of the four TV stations. And they show they projected a result that Hernandez was going to, he was winning with 43.93 as against Nasrallah with 34.70. But, we see the actual result is, quite different. Yeah,
the reverse, the precise reverse is the case. And then we've seen this in other elections. We've seen this in Argentina, Chile, and where else have we seen it? I forget.
Nicaragua, everywhere. I mean, the thing that's, a little disquieting for me is that very often what they do is they use these polls as an excuse to steal the election. Like when there's finally, you've had, where have the ballots been for the last 48 hours situation? And then poof, out they come. And the results look just like the poll, even though they don't look like the early returns.
Right. Yeah, and we saw the same thing in Venezuela as well, didn't we?
Exactly.
So, why does anybody care about Honduras, a tiny country of 9 million people?
It's a choke point. It was a staging area for trying to take down the Sandinista government, for taking down the Sandinista government back in the 1980s. That's one reason. It's a choke point between North and South America. That's another reason. If there ends up being a canal in Nicaragua, for example, and it ends up having some military significance because China ends up projecting power into the Caribbean through it or some other unforeseen outcome, well, you have, a friendly Honduras on one side of Nicaragua and, the other canal on the other side and U.S. military bases in Southcom on the other side.
Yeah, and right. So, you gave like 10 out of 10 for answering the question correctly.
Well, there's one other too. Of course, a successful leftist government in Honduras would, it would be contagious.
Yeah, and so if Nasrallah wins, what should he do and what will he do? And The reason it's important is because in Central America, the balance of power has always been heavily in favor of the United States, precisely because of its military occupation of Honduras.
Right.
You know, maybe that's an exaggeration, but they have various important bases. They've got a big base in El Salvador. They've got some smaller bases in Guatemala. Their main base is what used to be called the Soto Cano Palmarola Air Base in Honduras, which was where they flew Mel Zelaya the night of the coup. And that was heavily denied for some time, but now it's an established fact that the first place that Mel Zelaya was flown before being dumped on the tarmac in his pajamas in San Jose, Costa Rica, was the U.S. military air base at Palmarola. You know, so for the United States to claim that they had no role in the coup is completely absurd.
Right.
Hillary Clinton... This is a major defeat for people like Hillary Clinton that tried to stamp out democracy in Honduras. You know, you hear all this nonsense from the United States government officials and politicians about the United States promoting democracy around the world. Well, in Honduras in 2009, Hillary Clinton actively took steps to squash democracy in Honduras. And now this result by a candidate, essentially, Salvador Nasralli is the Libre Party candidate. And for him to win by such a big margin, it looks as though he's going to win by at least 5%, which in electoral terms in Latin America is a big deal.
Mm.
And that is a massive defeat for United States diplomacy, as it has been for decades, but in particular as it was under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and now under President Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson, the representative of ExxonMobil. Mm. Assuming that the results pan out, and assuming that, which is, you know, by no means certain in Honduras, Honduras is a kind of Alice in Wonderland country. Almost anything can happen. Yeah, and so let's see what happens. But as things stand, and if the electoral observation organizations have any influence at all, Salvador Nasralla should be declared the winner of these elections. Let's see what happens. Yeah. So what should he do if he wins? What he should do is purge the army, purge the police, and take the same steps that Juan Orlando Hernandez took to take over the judiciary. Right,
yep.
And he has to do that. If he doesn't, he won't be able to implement his policy program.
Well, and in addition to all of that, of course, and to enable that, you've got the question of the media. They have to democratize the media.
Oh yeah, just if you look at what we've just said, and how likely is that? It's extremely unlikely, Don.
Yep.
And given the control that the oligarchy have and their readiness to use any level of force and violence, and look at all the murders of social activists and community activists like Berta Cáceres and Margarita Murillo and untold others.
Right.
You know, and through all through Honduras over the last, ever since 2009. And that since 2009, there's been a kind of selective program of assassination, taking out important community leaders across Honduras. There was another murder just in days before the elections took place.
Yeah, and Berta's daughter was a candidate, by the way, for Libra for the National Congress.
She almost certainly got elected. I haven't seen the detailed results. No, okay. No detailed results have been published by Honduras's electoral authority.
Right.
Which, you know, and that's, you know, at this point, here we are, 24 hours since the opening of the polling stations.
Right.
They've had 12 hours since the polling stations closed to give out results, and there aren't any.
Right.
And so what will Salvador Nasralla and his eventual government, assuming that the electoral process takes the course that it should, and that's not by no means sure, assuming that it does, what will that government be able to do? And it's a real open question. And that, going back to why is Honduras important, it's important because in terms of Central America and the Caribbean, and more broadly in terms of Latin America and the Caribbean, and the question is, are these governments that get elected on progressive programs in favor of their country's impoverished majority, and are they going to be allowed to implement their programs? Right. Because we're back to this discussion about the ridiculous idea of a conservative. There's not a conservative restoration. There's a conservative conspiracy,
right,
to stop these governments with these progressive, anti-corruption, pro-democracy, anti-poverty programs, right, being able to implement their policies, and that's what the process is all about in Brazil. It's what the process is all about in Argentina. Yep. What the process is all about, crucially, in Venezuela.
Yep.
In Cuba, they had elections this weekend. That's 8 right. million people. 8 million. People eligible to vote, and a huge turnout, something like 80%. I don't know what the turnout has been in Honduras. It looks as though it's been uncharacteristically high in Honduras this time. But in Cuba, they've had their elections, and very, very calm elections, a huge turnout, and those people, what are they voting for? They're voting for the Cuban Revolution. And there's nobody taking part in those elections that doesn't believe in the democratic principles of the Cuban Revolution. But here, I look at the contrast between those elections and these elections in Honduras, totally dominated by the question of corruption.
Yep.
Is the result going to be allowed to stand, the genuine result, or is it not? That isn't even a question. It's not even close to being a question in Cuba.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the New York Times latest report shows. Here's the headline is, in Honduras election, ex-sportscaster takes lead over president. And it says Salvador Nasralla, former sportscaster running at the head of a left-wing alliance, was leading Monday in Honduran elections and was rushing to claim victory over President Juan Orlando Hernandez. And so...
Well, and that's also extremely biased, isn't it? Because Juan Orlando Hernandez, twice, even before the election, the polling stations had closed, and they were putting out that his media propaganda machine was putting out what they call boca de urna. I don't know what the translation is in English of that. The results that where you do a poll of people leaving the polling station and ask them how they voted.
An exit poll, yeah.
Exit polls, thanks. I couldn't remember the English phrase.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were putting out those results saying that he'd won with 45% of the vote even before the polls closed.
Mm.
No, and complete contravention of normal electoral law. So... And he was doing that, and if Nasralla's team hadn't responded to that, they would have themselves have been opening the way to electoral fraud.
That's right.
But they didn't. You remember last time we spoke, we said, let's see whether Zelaya and Nasralla and their campaign have learned from their experience of 2013.
Yes, that's right.
Where they were, and they did learn. And what they did was they made sure they got copies of all the final voting tallies from all the different voting stations. So they were able to demonstrate because in Honduras, it's the same as in Nicaragua, that each party has a representative in the count of each polling station. And each of those representatives gets a copy of the final result.
Yeah.
So, and what they made sure, what Nasralla and Zelaya and Xiomara Castro and their team made sure was that they had sufficient copies of those final polling numbers from each polling station to be able to demonstrate that they were the ones with the 45% lead. And that's how things stand at the moment. Right. Let's see what the final result given by the Honduran Electoral Authority really is. It's difficult for them because for once, this is one of the few elections that I can remember in which the electoral observation teams have played a genuinely positive role.
You know, because go ahead, sorry.
Sorry, no, because of the pressure they're putting on the Honduran Electoral Authority to do the right thing.
The exit polls are interesting. This past election in the U.S., last year's, the presidential election, the primary season in particular, the U.S. State Department, looking around the world as it, as the, great hegemon and, the exceptional protector of democratic everything, has a number, 5%, that is a vector from the exit polls that it uses to decide whether or not an election in some other country is legitimate. If the exit poll varies by 5% or more than 5% from the actual result, then they consider the election has been tampered with in one way or another and is not legitimate. And that was Hillary Clinton, as a matter of fact, looking around the world for her time, or 4 years as Secretary of State. That was the yardstick by which they decided what was legitimate, what was not, in places like, say, Honduras. During the primary season here, about half of the primaries exceeded that, and some of them, about a third of them, by multiples of 5%. In right. two cases, that double the vector.
Right.
Yeah. So exit polls matter to the U.S. when it matters, and they don't matter in the U.S. when
it's like
doesn't.
That's across the board, isn't it? And they take the data that suit them, and the data that doesn't suit them, they either
it doesn't exist.
Don't report at all or underreport.
Right.
Okay. So, and let's see what finally happens in Honduras. The big event for us here in Nicaragua this week, and everybody looked forward to the elections in Honduras, hoping against hope that there'd be a fair democratic result, and we still don't know if that's going to happen or not. But the other big event was the first anniversary of the death of Fidel Castro.
Yeah.
And that was a huge event here. There were activities across the country at every level, from community preschools right up to universities giving recognition to Fidel. The Cuban ambassador, it was very interesting to see the behavior of the Cuban ambassador. And through the day, he was taking part in all kinds of community events at grassroots with community preschools and things, doing for example, at one community preschool, the children were encouraged to color in pictures of Fidel. And, and there was the ambassador of Cuba working with these children, coloring in pictures of Fidel, and that's can you imagine that? And from somebody like the U.S. ambassador, although it has to be said that the U.S. ambassador here is one of the better ones, Laura Dogu, her name is. Anyway,
I remember that anniversary, by the way. It was shortly after my wife had passed away last year, and I was sleeping on the couch. I was supposed to go to Cuba December 1st, which I ended up doing, and which is, because it was the 25th of November, so it was, 5 days later. And it was a Friday night, and my Skype rang, and it was a friend who's a producer at Press TV, and it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, New York time. And I said, they said, Fidel Castro passed, I'd like to know if you would like to offer some comments. And I said, geez, I've been asleep, my head's a little fuzzy, can we do this tomorrow? They said, yeah, okay. I went, laid back down, rings again, and it was RT. And they asked me the same thing, and I thought to myself, geez, when I was a kid, I remember hiding in the hallways during the Cuban Missile Crisis of over Russian missiles that might blow up our school coming from Cuba. And I said, how can I not comment on the passing of Fidel, you know, on Russian television, on a Russian media outlet? So I did it. And after I did the commentary, and that's at my YouTube page for anyone's interested. After I did the commentary, my Skype rang again, and it was my friend from Press TV in Tehran who said, you didn't look fuzzy-headed on RT. He had seen it.
Right.
So I remember that night. That's my little story. And, of course, I was in Cuba while the while they were having the memorial for, you know, a week and 2 days. It was, you know, something.
Yeah, and the government here, Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo, did a really lovely commemorative event in Managua and with the Cuban ambassador present. It was a really nice event, and the key thing to that people in the United States might find difficult to understand is how alive Fidel is for us.
Yeah, well, across South America, Central America, and the Caribbean, because even in countries that now have right-wing governments like Brazil and Argentina, at least half the people actually support the left-wing government that they had, even the center-left governments. And to the extent there's room for any of that, almost everyone on the ground that sympathizes with the needs of working people understood which side Fidel was on and acknowledges their debt to the Cuban Revolution. And we got to stop there because we're out of time. And we can pick it up next week, and we'll have more results. We can parse a little more thoroughly than we have this week. So, Tony, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The nuclear agreement between Iran and the world powers is being thrown into jeopardy by U.S. President Donald Trump. How is Iran preparing itself for a potential throwback to the days of sanctions and confrontation? And what will it mean for the already troubled Middle East? Well, I ask former Foreign Minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Manoucher Mottaki.
With America threatening to scuttle the Iran deal, slapping new sanctions on Tehran, and Saudi Arabia going against its original foe in every corner of the Middle East, Iran finds itself in uncertain waters. Is Tehran aiming for the role of regional hegemon? Can it afford to run the risk of international isolation again? And how can it gain the upper hand in the standoff with the Gulf states?
Manoucher Mottaki, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on our program. Now, President Trump has been talking so much about scrapping the Iran nuclear deal, but now has promised to keep it in place. Will he want to renegotiate it, since according to him, some of the terms contradict American interests? Iran's foreign ministry says the deal is non-negotiable. Does Iran feel it can push America here, so Trump will cave in and just leave the deal as it is?
A comprehensive negotiation took place for a long, long time, and all the parties agreed on the nuclear deal, on Iran's peaceful nuclear activities. And then the Americans, not in the new government, but even from the time of Mr. Obama, they have changed their practical position towards this deal. We can say that so many articles of the deal have been ignored by the Americans. And for time being, United States is insisting for renegotiation or some new topics which they are raising are not related to the deal. That's why the officials in Iran insisting that the deal is not renegotiable issue. Americans, at the very beginning of Mr. Trump's government, raised the matter of termination of the nuclear deal. I don't believe that the Americans are looking for termination of this deal, because they know how benefitable was this agreement for all the parties, including the Americans.
Mr. Pataki, let me ask you a very straightforward question and try to answer it straightforwardly if you can. At what point will Iran consider this deal dead and renew its nuclear program? When does Iran say too much is too much? That's it.
In my understanding, if everybody in this deal takes beside of the agreement, it means the agreement is dead. For time being, the American took such a position. They have not terminated the deal, but they do believe we should keep the form of the deal, but damage the substance of the deal. This is the strategy of the United States. And time to time, take the case of sanction to the Congress and make some trouble for all the parties.
What will Iran's response be to the new sanctions the United States has imposed on it? What will the response be?
We do not have any will for the economic relation with the United States, while they don't want to have such a relation with Iran. Then, sanction of the United States is not important for us. What is important, the reaction of the other member of 5+1 to these sanctions. Till now, some countries tried to show that they have some kind of effectiveness of these sanctions. But with the new position of the United States, EU from one side, Russia and China from the other side, they announced their different positions towards the United States' reaction to the deal. If they follow this position and the standard that, as the commissioner of the EU mentioned, or Russia and China in different occasions announced their position, in such circumstances, United States will be shamed for its own position and nobody follows its policies towards this deal.
Earlier, France hinted that the EU could discuss new sanctions against Iran over its missile ballistic program. How does that go along with the European backing of the nuclear deal?
Till now, what the European Union announced is supporting the deal. Supporting the deal has two different parts. One side is encouraging Iran to be committed for the deal. And the second part is their commitments to lift the sanctions. Practically, yes, they have voted for lifting the sanction. This is the point. In other words, if Iran feels that this deal has benefit for Iran, definitely it will be committed. If not, will not be committed. This is the point.
The Supreme Leader of Iran said that using national currencies instead of the U.S. dollar will make Iran and its partners immune to sanctions. Do you think that's a good way out of the situation?
In the recent economic session and commission between Iran and its partners, they are talking about using the national currency, as you have mentioned, between the in their bilateral economic relations and economic cooperations. I think this is a separate but very important topic, which the countries should consider it very carefully.
When do you think it would happen? When do you think you're going to start using national currency?
I think the new movement which is started, for example, in our region, between Iran and Russia, between Iran and Turkey, maybe between Russia and some other partners, between Iran and some other countries in the region and out of the region, we have decided to use our national currency in our trade, in our economic relations and cooperations. And I think any important thing should start from somewhere. This is a good start for removing the imposed effectiveness of the one single currency against the world economy. I think the movement is started now.
Mr. Mottaki, French Foreign Minister Yves Le Drian has recently accused Iran of hegemonic temptations in the region. Now, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson obviously called France's approach biased and partisan in response. But just last month, Iran's President Rouhani said that no decision can be taken in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, North Africa, or the Gulf region without Iran's consent. So maybe Mr. Le Drian has a point here.
It is not a hegemony. It is based on two different approach to the same development in the region. For example, we have faced with the crisis of Daesh, ISIS. We have faced with the problem of Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and nowadays Yemen. These are different crises. The difference is different look to this, crisis. When you look through the realities in the region, you will reach to some point. If you do not follow the realities, then you will not reach to the correct result of the crisis. This is the point. Iran had the chance to follow the right strategy towards the crisis which we are facing for the last 30 years in our region.
Okay, Mr. Mottaki, we are going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll be discussing Iran's role in the Middle Eastern politics with Manoucher Mottaki, Iran's former foreign minister. Stay with us.
Listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And we're back with Manoucher Mottaki, Iran's former foreign minister, discussing Iran's role in the Middle East. So, Mr. Mottaki, you have mentioned a very important crisis. You've mentioned Yemen, and I would like to ask you a question about this, because Saudi invasion of Yemen was explained as a check against Iranian influence in the country. Saudi actions in Syria, Qatar, Bahrain are also explained as not letting Iran entrench itself there. So is the Iranian threat just used to explain everything that Saudi Arabia does? Or are they genuinely afraid of Iran?
In Yemen, a mistake took place, and that was establishment of a war against this country. Aggression against the nation of Yemen. This is the problem. This is the crisis. If we do not look to the root of the crisis, we cannot find solution for that. This is the point. The chance for Iran is looking to the crisis from the root point of the view of the issue, and from the very beginning, our position was quite clear. But unfortunately, some countries encouraged the aggressor to continue its war against Yemen in a state of mediation and taking part for ceasefire, for stopping the war and cooling the situation.
On November the 4th, Saudi Arabia intercepted a missile launched allegedly by Hezbollah from Yemen's territory occupied by Houthi rebels. Riyadh was quick to blame it on Iran, of course, and Iran denies that it sent missiles officially. But Mehdi Taieb, the brother of the Iran's Revolutionary Guard intelligence chief, said that the guard tried to send missiles to the Houthi three times, stopped by President Rouhani. Who is to say there wasn't a fourth time?
If we look to the history of Yemen, nobody could attack successfully against Yemen in the past. And the government of Yemen from 40 years ago, 30 years ago, have been concentrated on its defense issue. Today, reaching to the possibility for manufacturing of the defense equipments, including missiles, is not very difficult. And Yemen had such a possibility in their country. And turning the missile issue to out of Yemen is, a policy which is and a strategy which is very well known from the past, just putting the case to another country or looking for another party to say that this is their mistake, so and so. Iran denied to give missile to Yemen very openly, very clearly. But definitely, Iran is located. I'm going to talk about the Iran's position for solving the crisis in the region. Iran is located in this region. Iran will be affected by any crisis. That's why Iran should be sensitive for any happening in this region. What happens in Yemen, what happens in Syria, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, it affects Iran's security. It affects Iran's national interest. And definitely, we will try to show the best way for getting out from the crisis. This is what we have done for Iraq, what we have done for Syria, what we are going to do for Yemen. For Yemen, we had several negotiations with different parties. Our position was quite clear.
Mr. Mataki, you mentioned
yes,
Syria,
please.
And BBC is saying that Iran is building a military base in Syria. Does Tehran plan to establish a permanent military presence in the country right now?
Having military base or military cooperation between two independent countries is their right. If Iran and any other independent country decide to expansion their economic cooperation as well as military cooperation, is it against international law or regulations? No. That is quite normal.
So you spoke a lot about ISIS during this interview. So let me ask you, Iran's been very invested in the conflict against ISIS and neighboring Iraq as well, committing advisors, helping organize Shia militia units, sending other kinds of aid. What is Tehran expecting in return? A lasting and strong influence on Iraq through those new capable Shia militias, maybe?
I think now ISIS is quite clear that should be considered as a real conflict, real crisis for whole the world. now should the founder of ISIS reach to this point that who create some fire, they should reach to the typhoon. Who create the wind, they should reach to the typhoon. And ISIS does not believe anything. ISIS was a tool by the Americans, by the Israelis, unfortunately, by financial support of some petrol countries in the region for making insecure the region, not only the region, out of the region. Nowadays, we can see the effectiveness of ISIS activities in your country, in China, in Indian subcontinent, in Europe, here and there. This is the crisis. But Iran's position from the very beginning is completely correct, looking to the root of the crisis and insisting for bringing out the root of this crisis. And that's why announced we are behind and beside of any party who would like to fight with ISIS. We have been honestly with Iraq, with Syria, and fortunately the last city in Syria, the last city in Iraq were cleaned from the ISIS. And it was a great victory based on resistance, based on trusted cooperation between the regional country. It created a confidence building among the countries in the region, including Iran and Iraq, Iran and Syria, and other countries who have the same position. What will be the result? Definitely Iran and Iraq, two countries who had 8 years of war together, nowadays are deepening their confidence building, which is very important.
Samartake, I'm so sorry, but I will have to ask you about one more important issue, which is oil. And I cannot finish this interview without asking you about it. How does the current standoff between Iran and Saudi Arabia, with all these stern words and serious proxy conflicts, affect the two countries' work in OPEC? Do you think oil can be used as a weapon of war in the country's rivalry? I mean, for instance, the Saudis could crash the market again. They will survive, but Iran will suffer.
Never Iran believed that oil is a weapon of war. And this is one point. The second point is Saudi Arabia, unfortunately, since last 2 years, had stopped its diplomatic relations with Iran and is not in the position for any positive cooperation bilaterally between Iran and Saudi Arabia, including a correct approaching to the crisis in the region. But for some topics and issues like OPEC, like the price of oil, it seems that a de facto cooperation can take place between the not only OPEC members, but also non-OPEC oil producer countries. The reason is oil has no its proper price. And for the oil producer country, this price is not a normal price. Maybe we are not looking for a very high price, which was in the past 140, 150, around that figure. But the current price also is not a real price. In the past, 5 years ago, unfortunately, the policy of the Saudi Arabia was defending the low price of oil by any reason which I don't want to go in, it was considering as a pressure against some specific countries in the region, like Iran, like Russia, like Iraq. This was a common position of our countries, that the position of Saudi Arabia 5 years ago was moving in that direction. But in the last OPEC meeting, accepting some proposal of Iran or position of Iran, even by Saudi Arabia, including the keeping the capacity of Iran's production of oil, shows that practically, or in other words, de facto, there are some capacity for cooperation. That's why I am optimistic for such a cooperation, not only between the oil OPEC members, but also all the oil producer countries in the future.
Mr. Mottaki, thank you very much for this interview and for being with us today. We were talking to Manoucher Mottaki, Iran's former foreign minister, discussing the future of the nuclear deal and Iran's role in the Middle East. That's it for the latest edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.